Welcome to BIO, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. BIO is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with biographers about their work. This time, journalist and author Marcus J. Moore talks about his latest book, High and Rising, a book about De La Soul. This book, part biography and part memoir about a celebrated hip-hop group, was published by Day Street Books in November 2024. Marcus Moore was interviewed in August of this year via Zoom by BIO member Kevin Magruder.
So our guest today is Marcus J. Moore. He is the author of High and Rising, a book about De La Soul. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time.
I think maybe to start out, if you could talk about what you want people to know about De La Soul, particularly for our audience. Some people may be familiar with them, but for those who might not be, why is it important for them to know about this group?
I guess the main thing I'd want people to know about De La Soul is that, you know, they appeal to kids or adults like me, where in the late 80s, you grew up listening to hip hop, but you also listened to jazz records, or maybe you had a cousin that had a skateboard, or they appeal to people who maybe didn't always live in the city, they lived in the suburbs, you know? And I would say ultimately, like, De La Soul was one of these bands, or they are one of these bands because they're still active, where if everybody was gonna go this way musically, they were gonna go the other way. So if you think about the music that was coming out in the late 80s, it was all hyper-masculine, and there's nothing wrong with that, but, you know, you knew what you were going to get from LL Cool J. You knew what you were going to get from Rakim. It was going to be hyper-aggressive, grab you by the shoulders and shout in your face type hip-hop. Whereas De La, they had the same messages, but it was more conversational, and they indirectly let people know that there was more than one way to be Black. You know, you didn't have to always fit the stereotypes that people put on this. You could put on pastel colors, you could pick flowers, you can throw flowers into the crowd like they did at their first show. So I guess the ultimate tagline with De La Soul is that they were a group that made it cool to be weird and different.
This book, it's an interesting mix. It's a group biography, but there's also an element of memoir of your own connection to them and how they affected your life as well. Maybe you could talk personally why you were inspired to write this book.
So I remember when 3 Feet High and Rising came out. 3 Feet High and Rising was their first album. It came out in 1989, was known for pretty much revolutionizing how rappers can sample music. So for me personally, I just found that was always my aesthetic because, much like them, I grew up in a household where, you know, I had aunts that would be playing funk records. I had my cousin Eric was a DJ. So he was the one introducing us to De La Soul and to acts like Public Enemy and Boogie Down Productions. And so I had the blessing of being able to see hip hop come together in real time. And, you know, they always appealed to me because I knew then that that's the kind of person I would be. You know, I wasn't going to be the guy wearing the gold chains and the velour Adidas suit. That just wasn't my vibe. So here comes these guys and, you know, they're dressed like they just went to the thrift shop, but they're still making it look fly. They have music that's sampling Hall & Oates and Steely Dan and Michael Jackson and Smokey Robinson and all these people. And it was this patchwork collage that I really appreciated because I was also like a young artsy kid. So that's how I identified with them. And when I started to write this book, I noticed that their albums came out at very pivotal points in my life. You know, so I remember when 3 Feet High Rising comes out, I'm in my aunt's house playing it. When De La Soul Is Dead comes out, I'm about to go to middle school. And I noticed that my sort of temperature shifted, you know, in terms of how I felt about myself. Same thing with Balloon Mind State. When Stakes Is High comes out, I'm in high school. And so I remember when that record drops. So to answer your question more succinctly, I guess, the reason why it's part memoir, part biography is that as I was writing it, I realized that I'm just as pivotal to the history as De La is, meaning that, obviously I wasn't there when they were making the records, but I remember the records. And I wanted to take sort of a Greg Tate approach and say, like, look, I am part of the history as well. I know what I'm talking about, and I'm just going to write it. And so that's why I ultimately decided to sort of pivot on a dime around like chapter five. That's when I decided to go full on memoir. At my editor's urging, actually.
And then, because you're a music journalist, you're bringing that expertise and that experience to even looking at their importance in the industry, as well as what's happening with your life. Can you talk about each of the three members? And they're very different from the groups that people may know more about.
Yeah, so they're each very different people, and they're each very different lyricists and contributors to the band. So Pastanoose reminds me of a jazz musician in a way, because the way his cadence bounces on the beat, it almost feels like a trumpeter playing with an arrangement, because I feel like it's always kind of behind the beat a little bit, but not too much so. So it's almost like a Miles Davis melody where, you'll have, like with Miles Davis's second great quintet, for instance, you'll have Herbie Hancock, Ron Carter, and Wayne Shorter, Tony Williams in pocket with each other. But then you'll have Miles that'll just kind of come in slightly off the beat. And I feel like that's what Pos has always done in a really grand way. And he always structures his lyrics to sort of feel like you're dancing, they're very fluid and harmonic in that way. So I always felt like Paz was maybe the artsiest of the three. Now, Dave, aka Trugoy, he always kind of reminded me of like an older brother or an older cousin, where he was just as artful, but his cadence was going to be more direct. It was going to be more arm around your shoulder, telling you don't do this, don't do that, but not yelling in your ear. Even when he's talking trash or whatever, or even when he's battle rapping, it feels more conversational. It doesn't feel like I'm being shouted at. So that's how Pos and Dave sort of play off of each other. Maceo was a DJ slash producer, and he was sort of, I feel like Maceo is the mascot or the lifeblood of De La Soul, because whereas Pos and Dave can be quiet and humble, Maceo's not quiet or humble. He's going to be the loud, gregarious guy that's going to let you know, like, hey, De La Soul is in the room. So to compare it to another band, he sort of reminds me of like a almost like a hybrid of Chuck D and Flavor Flav from Public Enemy. Whereas Chuck is the more serious, loud cat. Flavor Flav was an underrated rapper, but he was the, mascot. He was the guy that was going to be on the side dancing. I felt like Maceo was the perfect synthesis of that. And so his sort of gregarious approach balanced Pos and Dave, and I think that's why they hung together so well as a group.
You mentioned that sampling was a major part of their musicality, and they were at the forerunners of that. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's accurate. Now, before them, obviously people were sampling before them, but if you think about that era of hip hop, you pretty much knew what you were going to get. Somebody was going to sample James Brown. A lot of the drums felt stilted. People were using the same drum programming, so it was going to sound the same way. Whereas De La, they opened it up. Maybe they would sample drums from this place, but then they're pulling from different musicians. So I think what they did is they sampled people who historically wasn't being sampled, and they're sampling genres of music that historically rappers weren't sampling at that time. So, at least to my recollection, no one else was sampling Hall & Oates. They weren't sampling Steely Dan. They weren't taking all of these patchwork little pieces of this thing and that thing and making it a broad connection. Case in point, I liken 3 Feet High and Rising not even to another hip hop album. I sort of liken it to the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's album, where they're just taking bits and pieces and they're making this big psychedelic collage. I feel like 3 Feet High and Rising in particular was hip hop's answer to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, in the sense that it's taken from all this different stuff to make one different sound. And that's what helped De La appeal to white listeners, quite frankly, because We already knew they were cool, but when that album came out, you started to see more white listeners tapping into what hip hop was doing and tapping in specifically to what De La was talking about.
And that kind of gets to how were they received in the market?
I hesitate to call them an overnight success because obviously they spent time making the music in Long Island, but they're the closest thing to an overnight success that I can think of because I remember when the Me, Myself, and I video came out, that's when they broke through. That's when I remember De La just being ubiquitous everywhere. Now, mind you, that wasn't their first single from that album. I also remember there was a video and a song for Plug Tuning, and I remember the Potholes in My Lawn video. But those were more so catered towards. They landed specifically with hip hop audiences, whereas Me, Myself, and I, because of the Funkadelic sample and because of the video, honestly, the video was funny and interesting. They were in there with these crazy hairstyles, and De La was unlike anything any of us had ever seen. The music was interesting and it was cool and it was lighthearted. So I felt like they blew up because they were palatable. And that's not a slight to them. They were just doing what they felt was right, you know, and it landed with all different kinds of audiences. But I have to be honest and say that part of the reason why De La Soul blew up is because white listeners tapped in. So they crossed over early. And as you could see, even after 3 Feet High and Rising moving forward, in a way, they had to remind their listeners that they were indeed a black band because they had blown up with so many different audiences. Because of 3 Feet High and Rising, because of the marketing and the music, that by the time De La Soul Is Dead comes out, it was essentially them reminding people that they were black. And as a result, they had been fighting against the industry pretty much since they signed their deal.
And when you say fighting against the industry, what was the fight?
They didn't fully appreciate the marketing because they were labeled the hippies of hip hop. And famously, Arsenio Hall calls them the hippies of hip hop on his show. And they felt it was a diss. So they had to fight against these labels that they didn't think were accurate. And because of Me, Myself, and I, because of 3 Feet High and Rising and the Dayglo colors, you know, when you had the flowers, the peace signs, and all of that, quite frankly, people assumed that they were soft. And so as a result, they would get tested on the road a lot. People would try to pick fights with them, or they would try to stiff them on some money or whatever. And there were very famous stories about them getting in fights on the road and beating people up on the road. So they had to literally fight people, but then they also had to fight for respect, fight to solidify a different sort of black masculinity that wasn't in the marketplace at the time because people saw the marketing and just assumed they were one way. And then they learned the hard way that they weren't that.
A through line in this book is the business side, and particularly because they're one of the forerunners of using sampling. When things begin to move towards streaming, they're not at the front of that. And can you talk about why? And that's a real important part of this book and their careers.
Absolutely. So it depends on what story you believe, but if you listen to Tommy Boy Records, and their CEO, Tom Silverman, he says that they didn't clear all of the samples for 3 Feet High and Rising. If you listen to De La, if you believe De La, you believe then that they submitted everything that they sampled, and Tommy didn't. They didn't do what they were supposed to do. So it's kind of a, you know, who said this, who said that sort of vibe with De La. But the reason why they weren't on streaming platforms for a long time was because of the liberal amounts of sampling that they did. And some of it wasn't clear. So they got sued. There was one sample in particular on 3 Feet High and Rising. It was like this little skit or this little interlude that used a sample from this band called The Turtles. And The Turtles heard it. And they took De La to court and they settled out of court. But it was the most notable lawsuit at the time. You know, other people were, you know, getting sued for, you know, not clearing samples. But theirs, for whatever reason, was the highest profile case. And so as a result, the label was a little shy about putting their stuff on streaming. And it took them a long time to actually re-clear all these samples. So even when it was announced in like 2021 or so, that their music was coming back to streaming, it took them an additional 2 years to clear all the samples from their entire catalog. And in moments when they couldn't clear the sample, they either had to take the sample out or they had to replay some of the songs. So you'll hear slight differences in certain tracks across their catalog. But even though they revolutionized sampling and they made sampling a thing in hip hop, because they didn't clear everything, or because Tommy didn't clear everything, that's what sort of kept them in the dark for a long time. Obviously, there's a lot more that goes into why they stayed off of streaming services, but that was the main reason.
During that period, were they performing?
So De La is interesting, and I think there's something to be said about mystery as marketing. So they were performing, obviously. I know I'd seen them a few times over the years, and because their music wasn't on streaming, I feel like it created this sort of mixtape culture within their catalog. Meaning, you remember like when hip hop first started, obviously we were all dubbing tapes. If you didn't have enough money for the latest Big Daddy Kane tape or whatever, your cousin would dub it for you. Or when CDs came into play, oh, I'll make you a CD of whatever. And I feel like that's what happened with De La. Maybe somebody who has a copy of Stakes Is High and they'll send you the MP3s, or somebody who has a copy of 3 Feet High and they'll like email it to you. I feel like indirectly, because they weren't on streaming services, it created a you had to be there moment with them. Like, oh, if you weren't around in the 80s, you missed it. Or we all privately traded their music behind the scenes, which, was fascinating because that's pretty much the essence of hip hop and just the essence of like culture. So it's weird. Like they still performed and they were still around simply because of their fans, I think, because their fans really do a great job of holding them up in magical ways. And I think that's what happened in the 20 years that they were off Apple and Spotify and things like that.
Can you talk a little bit about the writing process? Our audience are people who write biographies, love to read them, and what were the sources that you used? What was that process like in terms of putting this together?
I wanted to make sure that I spoke with people who knew them behind the scenes. It's one thing to reach out to this name or that name. I wanted to talk to like who were the dancers in the live performance from 1990? Who was the guy who designed the album covers, or who was the person who actually found De La and signed them to the label? So I was talking to people like that, which tapped into my music journalism side. I wanted to actually get sources who would talk, and not big names who would be afraid because, like, oh, a book. Because when people hear the word book, they just assume that it's going to be some gossip tell-all, and then they get a little shy about talking to you. So it was a combination of talking to people behind the scenes, but then I was also just kind of digging into my own brain and remembering how it was to actually listen to the music. Now, I've been reaching out to De La for about 4 years and they never responded. I wanted them to be a part of the book, but it just didn't pan out. So I decided to write a journalistic take on De La because I feel like my voice deserves to be heard. I've been around for a while, I've been covering this culture for a while. So I wasn't going to be intimidated by the subject. I was like, okay, I'm just going to write it as I need to write it. And thankfully, because it's De La, there was already a lot of source material out there anyway. So I tend to write as I'm researching. I know people who can gather all this research and then they write it based on the research that's right there. That's cool. I'm one of those, I kind of have to feel my way through it. I have to just kind of open up a doc and just start typing. And when I hit a place where I feel like it needs more research, then I'll research it and I'll go back to writing. So the whole process took about like 2 years. I started working on it in 2020, right when my Kendrick Lamar book was about to come out. Some life happened right in the middle of it, and then I went back and I finished it in early 2023. And then it came out last November, November 19th. So it was very straight ahead. I like to treat these books like I'm writing just one big article. I try not to be intimidated by the word book. I'll just kind of go in and act like it's a feature story that's going to be in the Times or something like that, which is kind of crazy thinking, but that's just, how I decided I needed to do it.
It
It helped
works.
my mental. Yeah, I had to trick
Can
myself.
you say a little bit more about the memoir element, you mentioned that that was a conversation you had with your editor. And what were the lines of discussion there?
Now, initially, when I thought this was going to be a straightforward biography, I started reaching out to a bunch of different people. I'd reach out to this artist, that artist, and they would say yes initially, like, yeah, sure, I'd love to talk to you. And then I just noticed that more and more people just kept flaking on me. And if I'm being honest with you, I got frustrated. And I remember the day I got frustrated because then I emailed my editor and I said, hey, look, I'm gonna have to shift this book because too many people are just not tapping in. So I'm just gonna write this thing. It's my voice. I know the history. I'm just gonna write it. And she was fully supportive. There was no pushback at all. She was like, absolutely. So that's where that came from. And it was a valuable lesson because I realized that I don't always have to validate my thoughts with various sources. I didn't want to write from a place of intimidation. And as much as I love The Butterfly Effect, my first book, I can acknowledge that I also maybe over-verified in certain places because I was just very apprehensive about writing the first book about Kendrick Lamar. Whereas with this one, I was like, no, this is the first book on De La Soul, but I know all of this stuff happened, so that's just what I'm gonna do. So yeah, it was just me trusting myself, trusting the process, and my editor being a staunch advocate for me actually trusting myself and writing it as I needed to write it.
With it coming out while the streaming availability was happening, have you seen any synergy there in terms of people coming to the book because they're coming to De La because of streaming?
That's a great question. I don't know. I haven't seen any correlation. I would imagine that's been the case in some ways. I don't have any numbers to indicate how many people have done that, but I'm pretty sure, like anything, because people did that with Kendrick in particular, that book where I noticed an uptick, after he had the battle with Drake and, after he started releasing music again. Then more people were interested in the backstory. So I'm not sure how many people did that with High and Rising, but I'm pretty sure a handful of people did that.
You open the book with a discussion of Dave's passing right at the time that the streaming is becoming available. But where are they as a group now?
The setup is different now. So obviously, with Dave being gone, somebody has to rap his verses. So now their live setup is it's Paz, it's Maceo, it's the Brooklyn rapper Talib Kweli goes on the road with them. And then I believe the rapper Pharrell Monch will perform with them as well. So now it's become a quartet. I think that's how they get around it, which is broaden their sound because what you're getting at a De La show now is you're not just getting De La, you're also getting some of Talib's music. You're getting some of Pharrell Monch's music. And so it becomes this sort of this rolling festival, so to speak, just within the context of their set. So let's just say De La Soul has an hour and 15 minutes to perform. You're gonna get not just De La, you're getting all different kinds of music, and it creates a more robust performance. So I heard they're working on a new album, or at least a couple of new albums. I don't know what that's gonna sound like without Dave, but I know their live performance. I've heard that they do a good job of filling in the space with other like-minded people. That's part of what the book is about as well, is grieving. How do you grieve in public? How do you grieve when everything is coming together and then it just falls apart? How do you deal with that, but then also keep face in public view? Because even as I finished High and Rising, my mom passed away. And so that's how I bring in some of my stuff in there as well. It's like, well, I have to move forward. How do I do that? How does De La do that in public? And that's a tricky balance. And so I was just trying to reconcile that in real time in the narrative. I think ultimately what I wanted to do with this book, I wanted to show people that Black people can be extraordinary and normal. Meaning, if you go take a look at the New York Times bestsellers list, or just matter of fact, just take a look at their coverage of books in general, they're only going to cover Black topics that are rooted in some sort of trauma or struggle. And the thing with De La is that it was none of that. They grew up in the suburbs. They made weird, cool music, and they were the definition of middle class rappers. And so what I wanted to do with this book, and Kendrick to a certain extent, is to show younger readers, to show readers of my age, just show all readers that, look, you can be a black person and be regular. You don't have to always have a cape on and save people. You can go be one of the greatest rappers of all time, one of the greatest rap groups of all time, and then just go home and watch TV. You know, we don't have to save the day all the time. We can take time to heal, we can grieve, we can love on each other, and that just be what it is. You know, it doesn't have to be anything extraordinary.
I would say mission accomplished in this book. The book is High and Rising, a book about De La Soul. And thank you so much, Marcus Moore, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for taking the time, and thank you for showing interest.
That was journalist and author Marcus J. Moore speaking with Bio member Kevin Magruder about his book, High and Rising, a book about De La Soul. It was published by Day Street Books in November 2024, and this interview was recorded via Zoom in August of this year. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music, and until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a great day.